I got into a bit of a kerfuffle about the placement of teak drives within the hierarchy of quality floppy drives. And while the argument itself wasn't all that scintillating, it definitely reminded me how important floppy drives have been and some of the breakthroughs that are happening in the contemporary space. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, Eric Vitello, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. The argument over teak drives arose from the fantastic situation that a number of people are working very hard to image all sorts of floppy disks conclusively, comprehensively, for the future. With the use of the applesauce now going into hundreds of more hands, we are seeing a situation where people are digging out piles of floppy disks, stored under all sorts of different circumstances and containing all sorts of different formats. The openness of how floppy disks could be written to means that the process of bringing the information back can be a little bit daunting. So it's great that people are trying to compare notes, figure out what's going on, and then bring out the images and get them online for analysis by others. And this isn't the first group of people trying to get this done. Multiple efforts over the last 30 years means that we are running into the same problems again and again. Variant storage quality leads to mold and dust getting onto the disks themselves and making them impossible to read. The different manufacturing standards of the disks themselves leads to some of them falling apart the minute they begin spinning again after so many years. And then there's the actual manufacturing of floppy drives. In the discussion about teak drives, it came down to whether or not teak deserved the place of honor it holds among many. TEAC, teak, is just one of the many different companies who were manufacturing floppy drives by the millions throughout the 1980s and 1990s. Sony, Hitachi, Panasonic, everybody took a hand in these. And as we've discovered looking back, many of them used the same factories or used variant subcontractors to make the drives before putting the label on them. And if quality was kept up, nobody would be the wiser. You would buy a machine, and it would probably have a floppy drive already installed, which itself wouldn't be looked at all that deeply, and at worst would be replaced if it stopped working. Here now is a whole other way of looking at these machines. We are sitting on top of thousands, tens of thousands of floppy disks in need of being read. We have machines that manipulate those floppy drives in ways they were never meant to be used, over and over again, nonstop, for weeks on end, constantly reading all sorts of floppy disks in various states of decay. And here we start to run into the edges of what these old machines are capable of. To anybody looking at the front of a standard floppy drive, they all look pretty much the same. A slot with a light and a small latch that you push down to indicate that the disk is secure inside. But on the other side are a whole range of variations, both in the quality of the read head, the configuration of the circuit board, the wiring, the machining of the chassis itself. All of these different factors were up for grabs, as long as it all fit into the slot of a standardized PC-compatible machine, anything could go. In working with these drives, I've been acquiring dozens of them. Others have been doing the same, and variations come to light. The reading of drives takes place through a recording and reading head that is very small, very prone to getting gunked up with whatever's coming off the drive and constantly in need of cleaning. Manufactured as they were for a time when the floppy disks would be relatively new, and even the most intense floppy disk user of the day might only put a dozen disks in over the hours, they are completely unprepared for how they're being used now. As a result, they break down. The floppy drives themselves might have their heads get completely covered with what's on the disks, and that repair is very easy. A little isopropyl alcohol, a little bit of rubbing with a Q-tip or a piece of cloth, and you're good as new. Other defects are not as easily handled. Sometimes the drives are out of alignment and they can't read anything properly. Others suffer mechanical failure, where a minor spring breaks or a connection between two points falls apart, and suddenly your drive doesn't work at all. Putting a drive back into alignment is a complicated process. Figuring out what part of your drive broke can be itself a major undertaking. It's easier, in many cases, to just wholesale replace it with something else that you've purchased or acquired from other means. The prices of different drives are completely variant and reflect the sources from which they come. Finding out where these drives came from, purchased as they are on eBay and other vendors, is a bit of a mystery. There are many cases of companies going out of business in the 1980s and 1990s, and all of their resources and all of their spare parts go up onto the market, or they're acquired by recyclers who then sell them at auction. If you're lucky, you are acquiring a drive that was never used, that was purchased in advance for an imagined army of workstations that never came to be. Other times, you're getting the pile of drives where people pulled them out as they stopped working, and they looked, in every way, like they were fine. Now you get to experience, decades later, the exact same problems that got that drive thrown to the side so long ago. And as for teak drives, the debatable gold standard of drives that many people are using to read all different sorts of floppy disks, the interesting problem is that there's no one teak drive. It's clear that trying to fill all of the orders, teak started subcontracting to all sorts of factories and companies. If you start to open up this model of drive and compare them, you will find very quickly how much variation there is in circuit boards, in arrangement, and in mechanisms. And while all of the different aspects of them are technically the same, you're going to have wildly variant experiences trying to work with them and repair them. The main reason for wanting this particular model is because it's a known quantity, even though things can go wrong. They go wrong consistently. You always have a path to either repair or knowing why any sort of attempt at repair is completely futile. Working with these drives, I'm reminded of one aspect of the PC experience which I'm glad to say is completely gone, and that's one of jumpers. For the people who don't quite know what I'm referring to, many of the circuit boards of all these different devices and cards that went into PCs had jumpers, small metal bridges that looked like plastic squares with two holes in them, and you would bridge two different pins using the jumper. This would be how you would configure a card, a drive, a piece of equipment for what it would do. Having a jumper across one set of pins would change how the drive would read disks. Another pin would indicate what it should do when it encountered a problem on the disk. Still another would allow the drive to identify itself, going from drive 0 to drive 3 as needed. If all of this sounds like rubbing sticks together in a world of USB, well, now you know why there's a world with USB. Having software control of the actions of a machine was so much more superior. Having these rare cases where we dip back into time and move small pieces of plastic across a circuit board remind us of how hard it used to be, how obfuscated the computer experience was. The sort of people who could be told that you would have to open up your machine and move a piece of metal between different parts of a circuit board to enable your machinery to work was a very, very limited group, and it held back a lot of access and interest from people who didn't want to live that sort of life or have that sort of body of knowledge. And for that matter, many of the aspects of floppy drives are that sort of off-putting. Understanding how the sector map works, being aware of some of the standards-breaking copy protection that was put onto floppy disks to prevent their being copied, along with the industry that rose up to allow them to be copied, represent to me an era well seen in the rearview mirror. That said, something about the form factor of the floppy disk is very attractive to people, and watching it grow as some sort of artistic reference, like a Victorian painting or a woodcut in the minds of people using computers today, has been strange, but also satisfying. If the image and the ideal of a 3.5-inch or 5.25-inch floppy represents something simpler, something understandable to a user of computers, I'm in no way bothered by the fact that they're completely unaware of how far we've come, how much better off we are, and how fast we need to work to save all of this old information before it, like the pain that they caused, fades into nothingness. Until the last floppy disk gets read by the last floppy drive, here I and others will stand, putting disks into drives as fast as we can, reading their contents, uploading them to the internet, and watching these previously imprisoned pieces of information fly free in emulators, in browsers, in artwork, in dreams. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Peter Healy, Emilio Oliveira, Ernie Hershey, Michael Rubin, Matt Reynolds, Sean Kelly, Manxalot, John Sturm, and Anonymous, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. By the way, it is my fervent belief that we are due a complete reckoning in how floppy disks are read. And by that I mean, somebody out there is probably going to create a piece of equipment that reads floppy disks completely differently than how we do it now. Designed as they were back in time, trying to deal with the economics of circuit boards and processing that they had, old floppy drives are read very inefficiently and with very little room for error. If anything gets in the way of the magnetic flux, or if there's any sort of degradation, the whole process becomes much, much harder. The applesauce drive has a flux reading mode in the software where you can manipulate individual readings to be able to figure out what something actually says instead of what the floppy disk now reflects. That sort of complication is fine, but it's clear to me anyway that somebody will likely make a version of a floppy disk reader that looks more like a big square clamping onto the drive and reading all of the window magnetically, at which point the software, either on a Raspberry Pi or its own custom hardware, that will interpret that one massive reading of the window of the floppy to enable us to have the best reading of the information on that floppy. The ability to read in the entire magnetic flux of a floppy was unthinkable during its heyday, but now we do that as a matter of course. It seems only logical to me, as we see this innovation happen, that this future vacuum cleaner of magnetic flux is on its way and will be able to once again revolutionize reading this magnetic media. I can't wait.